Vision Daily Briefing, live without a net with Tom Thornton. Tom, welcome to Real Vision.
Ash, thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you here. I think this is our first live Real Vision Daily Briefing together. Really excited about this. Tell us what's on your mind. And it's kind of like, is it fair to say, somewhat sleepy day in markets?
Yeah, it was really sort of boring. It was like one of the most painful down 21 bips on the S&P day I've ever seen. It's just, I mean, boy, it was tough. Wait, hold on. I got to turn something down here. I will say that this market is sort of status quo right now. Stocks are in this range. Bonds are bid, I think probably because the stimulus is coming in a little bit, maybe a little lighter than expected. Commodities, you have gold acting okay, sort of drifting higher. I'm long a little gold. Corn, soybeans, wheat, something I mentioned with Ed last time I was on, I was shorting and nobody wanted to short it, and they're doing great. What else is going on here? We've got the consensus dollar continues to be weak. We'll see how long that lasts. It's really kind of a boring market right now. There's no real catalyst.
Treasury is catching a bid here today.
Yeah, a little. It's not helping some of the financials. I thought the financials might have a little bit of a bid this week, but no, it yields rates are a little lower and financials sort of faded here.
Yeah, XLF is, I think, the down second most of any of the Spider Select sectors, off 1% on the day on XLF today.
Yeah, and you know, tech is getting a little bit of a relative bid over the last week, partly because yields and, you know, we've seen the 10-year drift under 160. And so I think they're, people are feeling like, okay, fine, the reopening trade is a little stale, maybe stalling out, and they're going back to the growth, dependable, big buyback type ideas like tech. And so you've seen Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, I mean, for no particular reason. I mean, you actually have a real potential negative catalyst with Apple and their lawsuit that's going on right now.
Yeah. So we agree it's kind of a drowsy day. Let's talk about the bigger picture, the reopening trade. How do you think about this more structurally? How do you think about this in a slightly longer term context? I know you have some insights here. Give us a bit of a sense of how you think about what's happening on the reopening.
Well, if you look at a lot of the stocks that would be the natural beneficiaries of a reopening, you look at retail, hotels, airlines, casinos. What else? I wrote down a few others on here. Restaurants. A lot of them have peaked. Maybe a month or 2 months ago, and they've made lower highs. And I think a lot of them got well above their valuation levels that really made sense. Now, look, I think a lot of people are vaccinated. I saw a thing today that 50% of the country's vaccinated. I got my vaccination. I feel very comfortable cruising around. I know that there's still a lot of people that are nervous and they still wear their mask, and that's all their choice. But look, I feel completely like we are reopened. I'm going to restaurants. I'm traveling this weekend. And it may be sort of like we've baked it in and it's as good as it gets for earnings. And I think it's starting to fade a little bit.
Yeah, this is so many interesting points that you bring up there, Tom. So on the one hand, you have this kind of weird sort of individual matrix of how people are re-engaging with the reopening. Obviously, this is something highly personal. Some people have health problems, perfectly understandable why they'd want to stay in. Other people, young, relatively healthy, and they're out and doing their thing. And how that kind of plays out. But the point that you made earlier about how the U.S. equities, the reopening stocks have responded to it. Maybe they got a little bit overbid as this sort of went through. And that's a great question. Is this kind of as good as it gets, to quote the movie?
Well, I hope not. I'd like to see, you know, things, you know, continue and not necessarily stall out right away. I do have I look at the Goldman Sachs factor baskets, and they have one that is comprised of reopening, typical reopening stocks. And I was looking at it today, and it's been going sideways. And we're on day 12 of 13 with an upside DeMarc sequential exhaustion signal. So we've got maybe a day or two more, and then we'll see if that we'll get a reaction, which typically happens after a 13, around 10 days after, or within 10 days after.
Yeah. So you say you hope not, but what does your logic tell you?
I think the market's overbought. I think it's running out of steam. There's been a lot of people out there commenting. Doug Cass was one of them, talking about low volume, and he thought that was a concern. You know, if you look back at all the big gains in the market, and you go back to even late March when the market ripped, the volume went down every single day. And I think it's just a matter of sellers just are holding on. They're not motivated to sell. When things are going up, you don't sell. You just sit tight. And you find fewer people as it goes up that are willing to pay up or chase higher. And that's the fallacy of the volume issue. I also will say that sellers always sell lower, and they get more motivated when they start to see, let's say, a five-day rolling average of their stock or ETF or whatever start to turn negative, but more likely when after a month something turns negative. And that's the hard thing for a lot of buyers, because they get stuck in these things and they think, oh God, it's going down. And they always sell lower. I mean, I can tell you, sitting on an institutional hedge fund desk in the old days, I remember someone from JP Morgan would call me and say, oh yeah, my seller is a little higher. He's not going to sell to you. I'm like, okay, I'll just wait. They always sell lower. Oh, people always sell lower. It's very hard to get people to sell, especially at these levels here. There's no reason. There's no catalyst. It's a boring market. Enough said, right? Oops.
Yeah. Talking of things, Tommy, that are not boring, we've got questions pouring in. And one of the first questions coming in comes to us from Tom. Tom, what are your thoughts on the crypto bounce back? Didn't seem to be any break in systems. Stress tests seem to have gone well. Oh, okay, these are two different questions. I think he's talking about capital markets on the second part. But let's focus on the first point here. What's going on in crypto markets? Talking about things that are no one's view of boring.
Well, First of all, I don't trade crypto. I do analysis on the charts with crypto. And I will say part of the reason I don't do that is I don't find an edge for myself. And I also will say that I enjoy my weekends, and I like when markets are closed. I like when things don't move. And it's just too much risk for me. And, you know, the risk reward is enormous. And, you know, more power to the people that rocked it on the way up. I'm thrilled. I mean, you're a prime example. You know, so many people that have done so well in crypto. The thing that I'm looking at it with crypto and let's say Bitcoin and in particular, you know, I've had a bunch of DeMarc signals, daily exhaustion signals trigger on the way up, and we get a 10% pullback or 20% pullback. And, you know, the skeptics will say, yeah, but that's just a good time to buy. And I'll agree. Yeah, it's a good time to buy. But those signals actually worked. And if you just sat there and you just stayed long, you'd have done great. But it's that one signal that when you combine it with a daily and a weekly that really makes a more intermediate top. And we had a signal at the top. And, you know, I said, look, I think we're coming to a top here. And I've been wrong on this a few times and the signals haven't worked. But, you know, I thought, OK, we're going to get a pullback. I didn't expect to see, you know, basic Bitcoin get, you know, cut in half. And, you know, I read these stories of people 100 times levered. It was going around today that got washed out. And, you know, the one thing I will say, and I really have a lot of respect for Raul and what he's, you know, brought in with all the crypto people on Real Vision. And I'm fascinated by everything. But he tweeted out some things today that I thought were really, I 100% agreed. you had a 50% pullback and nothing really blew up. There was no systemic blow up. There was no need for the Fed. There was no need, no brokers. I mean, they might have closed for an hour or two, but nobody really defaulted or went out of business. And that, I think, is a testament to the what Bitcoin is all about. So, look, I congratulate everybody. I think it's like, oh, wow, it's, you know, held on with this. But, you know, I don't think the volatility is done. I think you're going to have just incredible volatility, you know, at the lows. Let's see, I think we're on day 10 of 13 with a downside exhaustion. And so when we get that 13 on the downside, we'd have to make probably get closer to the 30,000 level, maybe even surpass it. And then we'll get a buy signal. And then we want to wait for a reversal, which typically is a 4-day, making a 4-day high. And a 4-day high could be up, you know, 40%. So, you know, it's sometimes good to even break it down into a shorter term chart, like a 60-minute chart. And when you see a reversal there, you know, you can buy it. But it's definitely a fascinating market. And, you know, I hope everybody's, you know, trading around it, not going crazy with leverage, which is something Raul mentioned as well. I mean, leverage is great on the way up, but on the way down, it's game over real quick. So I just, that's, you know, every disaster in the market has always been something regarding leverage. I mean, Bill Wang and Archegos was a prime example.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just true on the sort of systemic level. It's also true for individuals. If you're trading at 100-to-1 leverage, it's not hard to understand how you can get washed out of a trade. And when you're levered up at that ratio, it's you know, it's kind of nuts, particularly for retail investors who may not have a lot of experience, who think that they're going to get some kind of an edge. Leverage giveth and then leverage hammereth away. And you can find yourself totally washed out of the position.
Yeah, to think about, if you have a 10% pullback with 10 times leverage, it's you're basically going to be done pretty quick.
Yeah,
100 times leverage, you're just almost like the bid ask in the spread, like a half hour spread in Bitcoin, the way it trades. So it makes no sense, and it makes no sense that any broker or exchange would allow that for, especially with a retail account.
Yeah, totally agree. And at a 1% correction, you're basically roasted, right? I mean, you're
10%. You know, I mean, I would have been on the, you know, I could watch Bitcoin here 1%, you know, 10 times, right, in this half hour.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Tom, I have to say, one of the things I really respect about you is your intellectual integrity, your intellectual honesty. There are so few people who have decades of background in capital markets who are like open and curious to it. It's usually like a binary proposition, right? Either people go all in on crypto, or they're like, it's terrible, it's a scam, it's going to be the end of markets as we know it, and they just want nothing to do with it. I just so appreciate and respect your position where you say, hey, listen, I'm watching this, I'm looking for an edge, don't see one yet. But the people who have done well, that's great for them. It's such a rare thing here.
You know, the thing is, I was kind of making fun of it on Twitter last week, and somebody called me out on it, and I hit him on DM and I said, look, I'm just essentially kidding, and you know, no offense, but you know, I make fun of myself when I'm wrong all the time.
Yes.
And it, you know, that's part of the game, you know, and I try to keep things light and not take it too serious. I always have a managed position sizing, and I don't get over my skis. I don't really need to use leverage. I do occasionally, but you know, simply, you know, this is a business that can, humble you very, very fast. Can also, you know, blind you. And I remember, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Ash, but I was at a Real Vision blacklist event over a year ago. And yeah, it was easily over a year ago before COVID. And there are all these eclectic people that Real Vision brings in. I mean, really eclectic. I mean, just random. But they're all super cool, and they all have really cool stories. And I remember meeting this one guy, and he was, I think, he was in the military, and he was telling me, he was in his 20s, late 20s, and he said, yeah, I did pretty well in Bitcoin. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he said, well, I bought $10,000 worth really early on, like 2010 or 11, and then the Mt. Gox thing blew up, and he lost all of his money. Mm. And I was like, eesh. And then he's like, and then I had 30, you know, once all that ended and I learned more, I put $30,000, my entire life savings, into Bitcoin. And I said, wow, you know, and it was like, you know, it had already peaked at, you know, 17,000 or whatever. But he said to me, I asked him, I go, so how was that? You know, how was it when it was going up? Because I've never been more stressed out in my life watching this go up and seeing my net worth go up into the bazillions. I mean, he was, it's stressful on the way up and, you know, obviously on the way down. But he told me, he said, I got out in the near the highs in November and December of, I think it was 2017. And he hadn't gone back in. I don't know. I haven't seen him since or heard from him. But it's hard. You know, it's hard being in something that's working. Just as you know, when in 2008, my firm, the hedge fund I worked for, the financials team were short $1 billion worth of financial garbage, and it was working. But it was incredibly, incredibly stressful watching everything go down. I mean, it sounds like counterintuitive, but it's hard because you're like, okay, I've got these gains, but do I want to sell it or do I cover, you know, what do I want to do? And it's hard. My advice is to, and this is what maybe some people will learn from this massive crash. It is a massive crash. Take some off, trade around it. Don't be so stubborn to say, I've got to hold on to this because it's going to a million. And if it goes to a million and you've got enough and you've taken gains off and you diversify, you'll be okay. You don't need to have all your eggs in one basket. It's hard. It's hard to do. And even the best investors in the world will tell you, you can't do that.
Yeah. And this is one of the things that Real Vision that I really love that we do, which is, it's not just that we're covering these digital assets, although of course we are, but we're covering them as a macro asset class. And we're bringing people in such as yourself who have this life experience, this investing experience, this trading experience that's broadly relevant to talk about things like managing your positions, thinking about sizing, thinking about hedging, diversification, at what point you take some off the table. These are things that are valid in traditional capital markets, they're valid for macro traders, and they're valid, obviously, for people who are playing in the digital asset spaces as they're learning. And I sometimes fear that there aren't enough people like Tom Thornton in these markets to provide that context, to provide that understanding, to provide that life experience about how markets and investing work.
Well, I can tell you that I made lots of mistakes early in my career, and I tried to learn from those mistakes and to not make those same mistakes again. And, you know, in my where I really did great, well, were, you know, in the 90s, and I was just a tech bull. And I'll tell you this. Back in 1998, in the fall with the long-term capital smash,
yeah,
I had been watching the markets go up, and it was going up on very few stocks. It was just this narrow, they called it closet indexing type of move. And then everything fell apart, and I had a boatload of cash, and I put a ton. I think I put maybe a third of everything I had, which was a big number. Well, it was a decent number into tech leaps, and all my technical indicators were, you know, the bullish percent on the NASDAQ was at zero. If anybody follows the bullish percent index, with point and figure, it was at zero. So I started buying leaps in late 1998. For
people who don't know, tell them a little bit about what leaps are.
It's just a longer term option, longer term call option that I was buying over a year out, and I was really surprised at that time that these were not that expensive. You think that, you know, when volatility goes up like that, that these would be expensive, but I worked for Morgan Stanley at the time, and I had the head of compliance call me, and I had to go down and, you know, sit in the office and say, you know, they were like, what the hell are you doing? I said, you know, don't worry about it. And they're like, well, you know, you should put some money into other things. I have, you know, this is a third of my portfolio. And I said, if I lose money in this and I underperform the market or any Morgan Stanley fund or whatever, I'll put all my money in all the funds, and it ended up really working out well in my favor. But, you know, it's just, I could have really gotten murdered in that. And I did get out of a lot of stuff in 2000, before, and it wasn't necessarily because of some fortuitous call. I actually had left Morgan Stanley. I went to work for a hedge fund. I was a head trader of a new hedge fund, and so I couldn't be trading my own portfolio. So I was diversifying out. I was building a house. I just had a baby with my wife. And so we were just like, okay, we got to cash out. And it was killing me too. It was killing me. I was like, no, you know, Xilinx is going to go to like 300, you know, it was basically peaking that week and everything started to blow up, and I stayed in cash, and, I watched the tech market really get hammered, and you know, go back and look at diversification and go back to saying, oh man, if I bought Amazon on the day of the IPO, or I bought it at the peak of the first month, it was down 50% within a month, and then it went up, you know, chopped around, but then it went up 6,300%. Amazing, right? And if you held on to it, the next year it was down 93%. Now, that's like saying, you know, Bitcoin goes from 6,500 or wherever it was down to, you know, 500 or, you know, lower. And that would be like, I mean, you'd regurgitate and have the fear of what the hell was I doing, regret your whole life. So you gotta move things around. And in my old hedge fund I worked for, you know, we'd have a core position, we'd trade around it, you know, we'd get around it. We like it. We buy some, we sell some a little higher, backs off, buy more, move it around, and you can make money that way. And you're constantly moving. I just think that, you know, the buy and hold and hope is a very, very difficult thing, especially right now with this market so high. I mean, these markets don't continue like this forever.
Yeah. We should say, since we're live here right now, the last trade I got on Bitcoin looks like 37,608. You know, to put that in context, the high there about 63,000. Speaking of context, and I don't want to go too deep in the weeds with Bitcoin because we've already talked about it so much, but Wrecked Capital was out in the newsletter talking about the sell-off a few days ago. And here's an interesting statistic that I think is something that's worth bearing in mind. The statistic is that in 2017, of course, this is a great year, a Bitcoin bull market, massively so in all of crypto. And there were five major retracements. Those retracements were between 30 and 40% losses. So here we are down maybe a little bit more than that right now from peak. But again, highly, highly volatile markets.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's this, you know, the what I see with a lot of the newer traders and a lot of the Bitcoin traders is the whole you can never sell, you have to have diamond hands and all that. You know, that's the dumbest thing you can ever think, because that gives you this false sense of security that you know, stocks always go up or Bitcoin always goes up, and it may go to a million, and you can regret it and say, you know, I just made 5,000%. I took some off, and you can always buy it back. You know, if you get the momentum moving, you know, I saw Novogratz on TV, and he's like, you know, and I like Mike a lot, and he said, you know, I think that you're going to see the momentum come back, and we're going to be back over 5,500 or 55,000, and then, you know, we'll see a higher price later in the year. Maybe he's right, but the bottom line is you can always buy it back when the wind gets in the sail, and that's called momentum.
Right. And once again, we've said it before, we'll say it again, position sizing, diversification, these are absolutely critical points for people. And I'm not sure that that a lot of folks who've gotten exposure to this have had the benefit of understanding some of those things, because they haven't been in these markets and seen the cycles the way that that you have, for sure.
So I'm looking at, oh God, somebody calls, I'm looking at the comments, and hey, comments, somebody calls me bombastic. I mean, do I seem bombastic?
I would say you were the opposite of bombastic.
Yeah. I mean, I take that as a compliment. Thank you.
I would say one of your greatest strengths, Tommy, in the way you look at this is you have a radical humility in the way that you look at markets and the way that you view your own choices, your own decisions, and your own strategies. Radical humility.
So I've worked for a pretty high-level portfolio manager, the founder of our old hedge fund. And this guy was rough, brash, such an awesome risk taker. He could just, you know, he'd be sitting there after hours eating popcorn and say, you know, sell 500 Qs. And, you know, he'd want it within 10 cents. You know, I'm not talking 500 shares. I'm talking 500,000. And, you know, I had this, you know, I used to race bikes and I have this low heart rate. And so he kind of liked that. Like, I was always very calm. There was times where, you know, I bought 500,000 shares instead of selling 500,000 shares. I mean, that's another story. But yeah, I try to keep things light. I try to laugh a little bit. You know, during the day when it gets slow, I try to move away from trading. That's usually when it's the churn time. I watch Real Vision. I watch other YouTube things. I watch sports. I try to get a little further away from the boringness in the markets. So that's kind of the edge. You have to have sort of the downtime, and that helps me. That helps me. So I'm looking at some questions here.
Yeah, we should jump in.
Let's look at it.
Let's jump in. I've got some questions here coming to us from Gabrielle, who's putting these through from the Real Vision side. By the way, a real quick story for you, Tom. I remember when I was a young guy on Wall Street, and one of my friends who was exactly my age, we'd gone to high school together, actually, and I saw him, and he was just completely pale, like white as a ghost, like looked absolutely terrible. And I was afraid he had some kind of like a family emergency or something. What happened? I bought 100 contracts instead of 100 shares on a futures deal. And he was, I mean, I thought he was going to need to be hospitalized. Eventually the trade worked out for him. Fun story. I think he still runs that desk that we worked on together. So it worked out okay in the end. But listen, that's the story. Gaining this experience and understanding these things often comes through mistakes. Here's one, getting back to the questions, that comes to us from Prius Omega, one of our regular viewers. Thoughts on Apple and Tesla? Both of them are technically at critical levels right now on the 200-day moving average. And if you would, also, Tommy, thoughts on Amazon? Prius Omega.
Okay. Well, let's start with Apple. It's just a money printer, and I'm actually short right now. Just because this is the time when the stock tends to just stall out a bit after their April earnings. And look, they had just blowout earnings. The one thing that kind of sticks at me is that they didn't give guidance. They withheld guidance again. And I tend to think that the strength that Apple's had over the last year just gotten a little overdone. And I think it's more of a market call that I think it could drift down. And if it breaks 120 with some authority or sticks under 120, I think we've got some problems here. So it'll probably, I'd love to see it go, a bit lower. And I like, look, I went on Real Vision. I remember back, March of 2020, and I said, yeah, buy quality, buy everything you can and all the best quality stocks that you never thought you could. And Apple was my main stock. And okay, so
what are the indicators that you see that it's overbought?
Sometimes I look, the basic stuff. Sometimes I look at like weekly RSIs, the longer term out there, and I use the daily, and I use DeMarc indicators. And again, they're a money printer. They're buying back gobs of stock. It's a very tough stock to short, but it can work. And it's actually, as much as people think, oh, that's a terrible short idea, sometimes it's really a bad short idea when it's obviously a short. So that leads me to Tesla. So I've had a long history playing around with Tesla on the short side. One of the nice things is I stopped myself out last year. I think my cost was like split adjusted like 125, and I got out at 200, which was like 1,000, or and then it went up 5x, and it was just a crazy gamma squeeze. I have a bit of fundamental views on that. It's not just all technical, but I will say the technical, if you look at a weekly chart, it's just sitting here at this 600, 550 to 600 level. And my view is that it's running out of support. And you've seen the gamma squeeze. We saw one yesterday. And one thing that's kind of weird, and I put this in my note today, one of my derivative traders who will remain nameless, he's sort of a conspiracy theorist as well. He looked at the Tesla weekly options. And what's really been happening is you see these enormous buys of out of the money weekly options. So they're buying tons of out of the money options. I think they were buying the 610s, the 630s yesterday, and then it was in the 500s. And then they're selling puts, out of the money puts. But what's interesting is that the open interest is not growing. So my guy thinks that they are buying and selling the same contract, maybe with different brokers, and they have a prime broker that connects them all. And when you do that intraday like that, a lot of times they cancel out and you don't have to file, or there's no, it's almost a non-event. And this has been something that we've talked about, these gamma squeezes. So my view is that game might just end abruptly. And I think Tesla's in stress mode right now. They've got, of course, they've got Bitcoin, and who knows, it's probably near or maybe below their purchase price. And if that happens, they've got an impairment and they're going to take a loss. And that's why I always thought, what institution or a corporation really wants that type of volatility with their currency? Because I've seen like, oh well, we had a 1% currency loss, and the stocks get killed on that. We had a 40% currency loss, ouch. But
and by the way, there are no liabilities in that currency that I know of that Tesla holds on their balance sheet, right? There are no liabilities. They're denominated in Bitcoin.
Right. Well, the problem with Tesla, though, they may have a demand problem coming. And they've had 4 or 5 quarters in a row with positive earnings. And if you strip out the emissions credits, which you would have a net loss. So it's really somewhat of a show me stock. And if they can report earnings that are actually higher quality, and that to me is going to be the make or break with Tesla. And we'll probably know closer to August when they report. Now, Amazon. Okay, Amazon's been a great stay-at-home stock. They're diversified, obviously. They have AWS, which is an incredible asset, and it's their profit, you know, center. And they have Whole Foods, which is fine. It's nice. It's good. I don't think it's really moving the needle for them, but it's a good way for them to be on everybody's mind all the time. And they're going to buy MGM for $9 billion. Now, I used to be a media analyst and a trader. And I remember when Disney would buy Pixar or some of these others, Marvel, and they overpaid for it. They never paid, I think, 25 times for MGM or Marvel and the other ones. This is expensive. It's probably worth $6 billion, but I'll tell you this. The one thing about Hollywood, which Bezos is basically Hollywood, he's, you know, bought a big house, the biggest of the biggest houses in Beverly Hills, the Warner Estate. And he's kind of got that Hollywood vibe going. And Hollywood people have the biggest freaking egos ever. And they will pay up to get whatever they want. And I remember that back in the day when Paramount was in play and Viacom ended up getting them. Barry Diller was involved in that one. I also think that there's going to be a consolidation in the media place. So I'm long Viacom. I think that is a like fantastic, very cheap asset. And I think maybe Comcast could buy them. It's a bit, they'd be taking on a lot of debt to do that. But maybe Apple, you know, they have buying Apple Plus.
Buying a studio?
Yeah, you know, and a catalog. Paramount is awesome. And they have so much content. And Apple Plus is awful. I mean, there's nothing on Apple Plus that I really can say, oh, I got to get Apple Plus. I've watched a few. I love Ted Lasso. Okay, right.
But it's limited, right? It's a number.
It's limited. So they need more content and they need to diversify. Apple could tuck Viacom in with no problem at all. And they've got great management now. They're not buying back stock like idiots in the past.
Well, does Jeff moving to buy MGM push them in that direction? I mean, he's, you know, even if it's, you're saying it's worth six, he's paying nine. Strategically, he may think that that works as a premium for him based on the, you know, they're printing money right now. So why wouldn't they want to get, before it gets even more overheated, you never know who you're competing with in the future. Apple certainly would be on my radar screen if I were Amazon.
Yeah. So, you know, these things come in waves, and usually they come at tops as well when right. You get these ego-driven M&A things.
Those of us who are old enough to remember AOL Time Warner.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, oh, that was a disaster. But the bottom line is it's a land grab. And I think, you know, you look at, Discovery and HBO, CNN, the Time Warner stuff. I mean, that's a disaster with what's happening there, because AT&T way, way overpaid for that. And they just couldn't monetize it properly. And, you know, that's another one that I always thought that I didn't really expect Discovery to do that one. But, you know, and we'll see if this really goes through. But Viacom's the one. You can own that one. It's fairly low risk unless Bill Wang gets out of, you know, he comes back. Who knows what's going to happen there. But the problem is also you have a ton of stock that people bought in the 40s, and we really got to get above that level to break out, and because there's a bunch of overhead supply. But I like that one on the long side.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, let me tie this all back together. We talked crypto at the beginning. We talked about some sort of deep strategic thinking on equities. The union point on those two is the meme stocks. We have a question coming to us today about GME suddenly getting active again. What are your thoughts there?
Okay, so I'm short a little GME. I bought a little, or I shorted a little last week. It's run me over. I have the ability, though, to add more because I bought the smallest amount I possibly could just to get a marker on there. And I had a profit in it for a while, and I sort of let this thing the last couple of days go up. I don't see this stock as sustainable at this place. And there's certainly not the same amount of short interest in this thing. Trust me, I'm not going to, you know, get squeezed through this like, oh, my God, this is the worst thing in the world. But I will probably short more at some point.
Yeah.
His last words.
By the way, that question comes to us from Scub Factory. Scub Factory on the GME question. By the way, I saw an amusing one coming through Gurgly, suggesting that we can plot the entertainment industry executives' egos on log charts only.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's just, yeah, it's... It's crazy what they will pay, and they'll get in bidding wars. And I mean, we saw it with what was it, Fox, and when Fox was selling out some stuff, and Comcast. Who was the other one? I forgot. But anyway, it gets weird, and they just don't care. And it's a land grab, and it's prime real estate. I mean, I kind of know Mario Gabelli. I mean, you know, it's not like a, hey Mario, but I see him around. My neighborhood, and he's always said that, you know, Viacom is waterfront property, and they're not making waterfront property anymore. And except Barry Diller is with his new island, I forgot. But
that's right.
It's true.
Very true.
So sorry, I take that back. But the bottom line is, it's great assets. There are great assets there, and I think they'll be fine. Maybe Apple. I would tell Apple to buy them. You load up your Apple Plus. It's Paramount Plus, I think. So it'd be very simple to add the Plus.
Maybe for once, Tommy, the thought of the concept, the spin that bankers give about synergies, maybe it actually happens this time when you totally radically alter, improve, change the distribution network, and you have the ability to go direct into homes in a way that we've really never had before. I'd say it's a question mark, but it's not hard to understand why Apple, especially in the wake of this potential deal from Amazon, might want to think about doing that.
Well, okay, so investment bankers, they have this addition that they use. It's 1 + 1 = 1. But that makes total sense for them. And they've got to, you know, the end of the year is coming, and they've got to put these deals together. They've got bonuses to make, and they're going to jam some garbage together. I think there's going to be a lot of M&A going into towards the end of the year. I mean, look, they're missing out. You know, they want to get a New Hamptons house or redo it or get something. And by the way, I also think that house prices are starting to get a little toppy, especially in our area.
Double-digit gains month after month after month, going back to November. It's like 6 months of these. New ones out today, I believe.
Yeah, the problem with the home sales numbers that are coming out, the existing home sales, there's no inventory. And that's what's keeping the prices higher. But I'm starting to see, I follow the real estate market in Fairfield County, and I'm starting to see prices moderate a little bit, and some actually come down. Some are staying on the market a little longer, and you know that maybe the best ones have already been taken. So I think that you could see, you know, with the reopening and people going back to New York City. I mean, right? People are all over New York City having a great time, masks off, in bars, restaurants, right? That's where you're going right after this show, right?
They're literally dancing in the streets. I've physically seen people dancing in the streets on Saturday nights. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely happening. The opening is here. It's real. People are coming back. Also, I should say, new inventory presumably coming back up on market as construction ramps up. A lot of the capacity constraints with social distancing and mask wearing and stuff starting to come offline, meaning more construction, hopefully more inventory coming online. Tom, I should say, you know, these bankers with their funny arithmetic, those are your neighbors.
Yeah, I know a couple of them. I mean, they you know, they've got public or private schools and stuff that they've got to, you know, keep going here. But look, I think you're, I mean, just going back to New York City, I think it's so great to see people out and about. Restaurants are buzzing. I was on OpenTable and I was trying to get a reservation and it was like, oh yeah, we can take you at 5 or 10:30. Now I could probably do 5 because, you know, I kind of like eating early and, you know, I'm an early to bed type guy, but like, come on, you know, there's no 7 o'clock reservation anywhere, nowhere.
I tried to make a reservation on Mother's Day. And they were charging $25 a head at some restaurants to make the reservation before you got booked.
Yeah,
it's completely insane.
I did I sort of tried to get Mother's Day reservations someplace here, and it was like no. But it's, you know, things are open more now. I've gone to restaurants, no mask. Let's go. Let's have fun. And you know, that's, you know, we deserve it. We've all been cramped in our houses and apartments and working from home. And I saw David Kostin was on TV on Bloomberg today, and he said it was the first day everybody's back at Goldman Sachs. That's nice.
Today.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. And, you know, it's going to be a change because you can work from home. And a lot of these investment bankers can do Zoom calls from the office. So there's going to be a difference in travel, business travel. So yeah. I'm looking at some of the
airlines up on the day, outperforming the indices.
Yeah, they'll be down tomorrow. Everything's like up or down. It's like a flip flop. It's just it's so hard to get a couple days in a row of something working. I mean, it's just like, oh, it's up. Then next day, wham, right in my face. You know, everybody's like, oh, we should.
Glad we had the opportunity to do a very sort of strategic Real Vision Daily Briefing to think about this on a kind of quiet day in markets. By the way, I have to say, I've been looking at the comments. I see a huge amount of love for Tom Thornton coming over the comments for the last 25 minutes or so. So let's...
Checks in the mail.
Let's sum it up here, because I know we've run a little bit long. Give us your final thoughts, all the topics we've discussed today, the big picture, where you think we're at, where you think we're going, and what you're going to be watching as we get there.
Okay. I think we're still going to be range bound for a while, unless there's some catalyst or some real negative facet that comes in. And that could be, you know, the stimulus, could be the Fed. I think the Fed is trying to thinking about doing some sort of change in policy. I think the June 4th, if it's that a Friday, that jobs number is going to be epic. I mean, it was terrible, relatively speaking, of what people expected last time. And I think the data is going to come in real hot, and I think the Fed's going to have to make a move, and they're going to have to signal that they're thinking about it. Mm. So maybe at Jackson Hole, they'll say, okay, here's our plan. Maybe too late. And the market might start to wane a bit. So my view is that it's kind of a boring market, honestly. Sometimes it's better to do very little. But just, you know, get ready. I mean, I think we could see if we get a pullback, 5, 10%. I've been saying 39.50. We get that, I think you can put some money to work in some good, solid places. I like energy. I like financials. There's some tech. I'm long some tech right now, which is crazy. So, you know, just sit tight, go out, go to a restaurant, support the restaurants, have fun.
and enjoy your life this summer. Tom, as always, very well said, very succinctly said at the end, and you're not afraid to take a position. Always appreciate that here on Real Vision.
Well, thanks, Ash.
Tom Thornton, thanks for joining us, and thank you for watching, everyone.